Blog Talk Radio.
Talk Radio, where we discuss business, politics, and culture. I'm your host, Donya Keating, live in the Seattle area today at 2 p.m. Pacific Time on Thursday, November 6th. Really special shout-out today to Tim Ryan Construction, who agreed to let us move the studio onto their site today since we were dead in the water. Thanks, Comcast. Really appreciate being able to continue with business as usual here, Sarah. Listeners, dial 646-378-0261 to chime in live. Press 1 on your keypad when you're ready to speak. If you'd rather send us a comment or a question via chat, you can open that up and go. Maybe a little bit touch and go from what we've been hearing, unless you have a Blog Talk Radio account, but, you know, give it a shot. This afternoon, we're going to have a fireside chat, minus the fire, with one of my favorite Washington State policy wonks, Lou McMurrin. He's president at McMurrin Enterprises. Before he formed his consulting business, he spent 13 years as a lobbyist in Olympia for the Washington Technology Industry Association. He's highly respected by business and tech leaders and politicians, and we are just going to roll today with several topics here about business, and we're going to talk about policy, the elections, trends, and whatever else comes up for us. So welcome, Lou. Are you out there?
I am, Donya. It's great to be here with you and your listeners today.
Great. We're great to have you. So we're going to just dive right in. And why don't you start out by telling us a little bit about yourself and what you've done in your career and just kind of bring us forward to what you're doing now.
Great. Thanks. Well, you mentioned 13 years at the WTIA, Washington Technology Industry Association. For the previous 12 years before that, I lobbied for financial services. I came up through good old HFC, which actually doesn't exist anymore. I came up through through the branch office system, was in the right place at the right time back in 1989 when they needed a government relations director for this region. I was there until 96. Then I went actually for a short time lobbied for King County as their legislative liaison to the state. That was quite an education on local government. Then I spent 3 years at the Washington Public Utility District Association in the late 90s during that time of energy deregulation and all those issues and questions. That was a pretty interesting time in the utility and energy business. Was there until 2000, then went off to WTIA, which was then known as the Washington Software Alliance. And then over the past year, I decided I needed to make a change and wanted to be in business for myself. And so I've been dabbling in a number of different areas. I'm working actually with a couple of interesting startups in the Seattle area, one in the healthcare space, one in cybersecurity. Kind of went back into the insurance game, so I've got a health, life, and disability license, so I can offer health and health insurance. And just working with a lot of interesting startups, meeting a lot of people, staying around the tech sector, and just trying to provide value wherever I can.
So you mentioned that you were working with some startups. Is it okay if you mention who they are and what you're doing?
Yeah, absolutely, if you're open for that. So one, on the healthcare side, I'm working with a gentleman, a cardiologist out of Kirkland, who has formed a company called analytics4medicine.com, if you want to go check it out. And his other company is called Chi Squared, chisq.com. The piece that is really, I think, both pieces are really quite interesting, but the piece that is really healthcare related and really can drive some improved healthcare outcomes is this online tool for doctors and patients to treat hypertension more effectively. So we're working on looking for some health insurance customers and some other folks who may be large self-insured employers that really have large healthcare costs. Hypertension is very poorly treated and always ends up, not always, but ends up with real bad outcomes, strokes, heart attacks, and other things. And if we can drive those costs down, health insurers will benefit, consumers will benefit, doctors will. This tool really helps doctors manage that problem better. So that's one thing. And the other one is a cyber risk marketplace, and we're developing what we think is a really great solution to all the cyber risk and cyber threat problems that are out there that are just enormous and really taking a toll on the economy, taking a toll on businesses, consumers. just the inconvenience factor and loss of reputation is in the billions of dollars these days. So those are the two specific ones I'm working on, but also involved in a number of other things. Looking at this crowdfunding issue, I think, is really interesting, the crowdfunding law, and certainly after yesterday's initiatives in both Oregon and Alaska, the cannabis industry is certainly on the grow. I guess that's an unintended pun there, but certainly you see Washington, Colorado, and now you're seeing sort of a West Coast cannabis market really open up here. So that's an interesting industry, to take a look at.
Yeah, and we're going to talk a little bit about that, the marijuana, the advisory excise tax, number 8 vote that we had in the state. That's still maintained at 53% the last time I looked at it. But we're going to go through like some of the issues and kind of get your feedback and your opinion on some of those, being the wonk that you are.
Sure.
So as we all know, the November 4th election results are kind of top of mind for many of us out there. So, some big but predictable changes came about. You know, there's kind of a red tide going across the country. And then there were a few surprises or upsets thrown in there. So in our own backyard, we've got Larry Sechrist. He's a representative, a state representative. And it looks like he might be ousted by Michelle Caldeir. We also have Kathy Hay, who's being unseated by Daniel Griffey. Jesse Young is winning his race. And the big one at the county commissioner level, obviously, is moderate Republican Ed Wolf over the incumbent Linda Streisguth, who was appointed by her party earlier this year when Josh Brown left to take the head position over at Puget Sound Regional Council. So others were easy and expected wins, like, you know, State Senator Jan Angel. That's kind of a no-brainer. And Coroner Grid. Mm-hmm. Greg Sandstrom. I think Treasurer Meredith Green was kind of a no-brainer. And, you know, another thing that we're dealing with is the recent change in the numbers, where Tina Robinson, she actually has a slight edge over the incumbent prosecuting attorney, Russ Haughey. But I wanted to get your thoughts about the races and the specific wins and losses here, but also nationally. And then kind of get your feedback on what are the implications, and then after that kind of roll into your 2016 predictions.
Okay, great. So I'll start with national, and clearly, I mean, I was somewhat surprised. I mean, I think it was pretty well, you know, the polls were showing the Republicans were going to do well in the Senate, and that they might re-get it, but there was always the risk that they could shoot themselves in the foot. But when you look at those pickups, that was quite substantial. I mean, and so they held every seat, and then they gained seats. And it looks like, and I don't see how Mary Landrieu survives the Louisiana runoff, and then you've got this Virginia race, which is super, super close right now, but, you know, the Republicans are going to probably pick up, you know, get 53, but really, and then, you know, they got more seats in the House, the U.S. House, which, frankly, I thought was also a bit surprising, but really the area which was, you know, I think where the Democrats really have to pay attention here is at the state houses, where, I mean, Maryland elected a Republican governor. I mean, Maryland is essentially a client state of Washington, D.C., and they elected a Republican governor. You look at Illinois. I mean, you know, Illinois used to go back and forth, but for a while it's been pretty Democrat, and they have elected a Republican governor. And then Massachusetts, of course, they've elected Republicans in the past for governor, Mitt Romney being one, but that was one where, you know, Martha Coakley again could not win a statewide race. In fact, the joke on election night was that Scott Brown should have stayed in Massachusetts. He could have won the governor's race instead of losing to Gene Shaheen up in New Hampshire. So, you know, should have stayed within his own boundaries. You know, in our state, I mean, really not a lot of surprises. You know, those three closed House races, really kind of really in your area, you got the 28th, the 26th, and the 35th district are really the three that are, you know, will determine whether or not the Republicans have either 48 in the state House or 45. But either way, they did pretty well. They held the Senate and picked up a seat, actually, with Mark Melosha winning that Federal Way seat and Andy Hill keeping his seat and all the incumbents keeping their seats. So that will bring, of course, you know, divided government back to Olympia, which in my experience and those of us that have been in the game actually kind of prefer that situation. But that's sort of an insider's game on that. But and then also, too, interesting, you know, the ballot measures being what they were, seeing 1351 as close as it is and then seeing 594 pass pretty substantially. So. Interesting results as always. You know, we show ourselves to be kind of a purple state. I mean, even though we're generally blue in a lot of areas, we, you know, when you get down into it, we're pretty purple. And so there's a lot, you know, a lot's going to go on to bring up for Olympia. There is obviously this McCleary decision that hanging over the legislature's head. You know, technically they've been found in contempt. I was just reading through some of that the response from the legislature about they said, hey guys, you know, don't hold us in contempt here. We're doing the best we can in a messy legislative process. And so I tend to be a little bit sympathetic toward that. But the reality is that the legislature is going to have to put in a pretty substantial chunk of change in this next biennial budget for education to comply with McCleary.
Yeah, and I was looking at the 1351 numbers the other day and how we have basically in Kitsap County, we were at 52.2% or something like that. Well, we're saying yes. At the statewide level, we're still at a no. I mean, obviously there's some more results coming in this afternoon or about 5 or 6 o'clock, but we're still at a no statewide. And I'm one of those people that really did not want 1351 to go through because it's one of those things where, yes, we have an obligation to do something about education. We have to fund some of these mandates. We also have to reconfigure the way that we operate the system. But the other part of it is the answer is not just to throw money at putting, you know, reducing the class size. That's only one part of the issue. And, of course, because you and I deal with technology, it's you have to start thinking about it, incorporating the way that technology is changing the way that schools and classrooms are going to be functioning going forward. We keep trying to train our kids for a world that they're not going to be living in once they're done. And so we really have to start thinking about how much money do you throw at a system that, you know, very well may be extinct by the time our kids get to college or my kid gets to college? We have to start thinking, you know, be more forward-thinking in our strategies, in my opinion. Let's jump back a little bit to some of the initiatives that we – and it looks like somebody wants to join in. Let me see who this is. All right. Who is out there with us? Somebody out there or no? Okay. Well, we'll just see. If they jump in, they jump in.
Hi. This is Charles.
Oh, hi, Charles. Welcome. We're just talking about initiatives. We're talking about some of the things that we were dealing with in the election. So guns and the Washington State, 591 versus 594. Lou, why don't you pretend that you're talking to people out there that don't know what it was and what the distinctions are, and just give them kind of a quick and dirty.
On the two gun initiatives?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Well, so 594, okay, let's say 591 essentially was a status quo initiative. It basically said, and in fact, it was very simple. It was one of those you could actually read pretty quickly and understand it, and basically said, look, if the federal law changes regarding background checks, that is sufficient for the state. So it was basically a status quo vote, and had no real fiscal impact or anything of that nature. 594, of course, actually was something different and requires background checks, so for non-licensed firearm dealers. So these are private sales or gun show sales and that kind of thing. So I think a lot of folks saw that it was closing a loophole, quote-unquote, and felt that it was a reasonable way to do so. Again, after reading through the initiative, and again, you look at things, you know, these horrible incidences like we recently had up in Marysville and other things, and people really feel like they want to do something. And if this initiative can limit sales to those that would use guns in illegal and unfortunate and violent way, maybe that's a good thing. I tend to be pretty Second Amendment, but I didn't see the need for this as much. But again, if it can do something. It won't prevent random gun violence. I mean, that's the thing. There is no panacea for that, but it could close a certain loophole, and it could maybe prevent some bad people from getting guns that they should not have. So, if that's the case, I hope that's what it does. I hope it doesn't do more than that. There are some exemptions in there. It's always the case is how does it get enforced, and how will it, how do law enforcement agencies actually go about doing it? How will does it creates new crimes, and so it creates new penalties. And if you're, if you do a second violation under this new law is a Class C felony. So it's pretty serious if you do violate it.
Absolutely. Charles, are you out there? Do you have any comments or thoughts about 591 versus 594?
Well, I don't think we need to make it easier to own guns, but those that have their legal rights, that are entitled to purchase guns, they should be able to. I see no reason why I should be able to, you know, go to a gun show and buy a gun, though. In a lot of ways, I think, you know, it levels the playing field. If you're a legitimate dealer and they do a background check, why would you give them the option or have an option where somebody could go somewhere else and an unlicensed person or somebody who wouldn't pass a background check could purchase a weapon? Yeah, that's a loophole. So closing a loophole I don't think is a problem. On the other hand, I didn't read the entire text of the initiative, so, you know, that being said, sometimes the intent of something sounds good, but when you get down to the wording of the application, that's where there can be problems. So in that respect, to tell you the truth, I don't know, but I don't think it's not going to do a substantial amount of harm, and it does have the possibility to do some good. So there you go. I think that's kind of where I lie with it.
And do you have any thoughts on 1351 and the class sizes?
Oh, my God. Thank God it's probably not going to pass. And the reason for that is I think that would just be horrible. First off, it's kind of like one of the worst budget-busting type initiatives. I think the problem I have with a lot of initiatives is if they're designed to reduce flexibility, then that's a bad thing. In other words, you don't want to set a cookie-cutter standard that says, well, all class sizes need to be small. Because it really depends upon those students. It really depends upon the situation. It really depends upon a lot of different factors that can't be just broad brushstroked into a legislation. And, for instance, if you just tried to reduce class sizes in a district that, say, doesn't have physical space, what are they going to do, build another school? You know, it could be potentially horrendously expensive for that district to be able to comply. Whereas, on the other hand, you know, maybe they can add additional teachers within a classroom in order to comply and provide a better, you know, I want to see whatever's going to provide the best educational result for the money. We have to think about efficiency in the way we provide education. And I think that legislation would have reduced flexibility and would not have been a very efficient way of improving our educational results. I think that was its critical flaw.
I just got a comment coming through saying that McCleary was basically another unfunded mandate, and that's why it doesn't have any teeth. Any comments on that?
Well, when the courts make a decision, there's certainly some teeth involved. But, you know, if you look at school K-12 spending over the past, you know, 20-plus years, it's gone up and up and up and up. I mean, it always goes up. 1 year, 2010, it went down. I mean, that was in the depths of the recession. So, again, I'd have to, you know, agree with Charles. And I think the fact that it's failing when there was absolutely no campaign against 1351, I mean, people, I think they really sat down and read and they looked at that fiscal impact and they said $4 billion or, you know, it's a substantial amount of money. And they saw that it wasn't always going to teachers, classroom teachers. I mean, there were a whole bunch of other non-certificated staff that were going to get hired out of that. Plus, knowing the fact that McCleary was sort of out there in the ether, I think people said, okay, this is not such a good idea. I mean, I thought it was really interesting that it failed in Thurston County. What does that tell you? It tells you that the folks who generally, and that's a very much of a state employee, you know, county, right? I mean, they saw that, wait a minute, this could take away from social services. This could take away from higher education. This could be a real problem. And I thought it was really interesting that Thurston County, which is certainly, you know, no conservative county by any stretch, voted against 1351.
I think on the state level, every newspaper editorial board recommended against 1351. That is telling.
Yeah.
And you, at your, Charles, the Westtown Technology Association had an annual summit that just took place, and I want to say it was October or whatever. My time runs together here. But Renee Ratcliffe Sinclair was the keynote, and she used to lead the strategic initiatives for Apple. And one of the things that she said about McCleary, obviously, is that it puts a lot of emphasis or focus on the K-12 conversation, but it really leaves out the university K-20 level type conversation, because we're not really focusing beyond that, where there are some significant problems that are not being addressed, particularly in Washington State, regarding these students and their ability to go into UW or other universities, where those seats are really very limited. So do you guys have any comments on that? Any thoughts about that?
Well, you know, that was an area that I certainly lobbied a lot on, was support for higher education, particularly around the STEM-related degrees.
Uh-huh.
The one thing, I mean, that's the thing, higher education, this is across the states, you know, is a place where states balance their budgets. They're very reluctant to deal with K-12. And, of course, we have a constitutional issue around K-12, so it really does require a substantial portion of our state budget. Then we've got those drivers like Medicaid and other where, you know, of course, Washington State would never think about, well, we shouldn't expand Medicaid. No, we got to expand Medicaid. So we spend more to get more federal money. And it really squeezes that higher education budget, which is not, you know, which is not sacrosanct, nor is it protected. But frankly, our higher education system is pretty darn efficient. The kids that we get into the system, they come out in a pretty reasonable period of time and generally are getting employed especially depending on the type of major that they're taking. On the community college system, of course, very workforce oriented. So there's a lot of programs at the community colleges where you go get your certificate or your AA, and you know you're walking right into a $50,000 or $60,000 job, you know, in a skill that is, you know, probably not outsourceable. You know, but when we've seen this legislature put money into when they target money, especially, you know, again for computer science and engineering, the universities respond, and now you're seeing now with a lot more student demand, which is great. A lot better student achievement, and so the slots then again. So the universities, of course, are taking a small percentage, but when they get funded, at least they can take a higher percentage, and then there's less pressure to take those out of state students that pay, you know, the full three x tuition of an in state student. So,
right.
So it's going to be tough. The budgets are always going to be tough on higher ed. But higher ed really, in our state, does a pretty darn good job of providing a good education where students are coming out employable and work ready.
Well, that's an interesting comment or a series of comments, because we do a lot of stuff like you with, you know, Technology Alliance and all of the, you know, Microsoft and all of the other tech sector companies here. And we hear just the opposite. We hear that they have a really challenging time, you know, filling that talent gap, and that they are not able to find people, and, you know, that we're not educating our students at a level that's competitive. And, you know, you look at the numbers, even going back to the time when we were dealing with Technology Alliance on a larger level, that they said that, you know, Washington State, the way that it performed nationally, was very, very low. We are a great importer of talent, and we attract a lot of talent because, you know, we really have a really strong tech sector here, an IT sector here. But in terms of producing our own, we are still hearing a lot of feedback, and I know Charles can speak to that as well, that we really aren't getting our students up to snuff in terms of education, and especially in that IT or technology space. Charles, do you want to offer some comments on that level?
Couple of them. One, I think a lot of that's directed towards capacity in terms of like the number of technology-based and STEM engineering-type degrees that are available, the slots for those. Apparently, like, you know, first off, we don't have a deep university system here compared to some other states that are, quote-unquote, considered our peer states. You know, we have UW, we have a couple of you know, universities, but, you know, beyond that, it gets much thinner.
Mm-hmm.
And I think so just in terms of raw capacity, there hasn't been enough capacity in terms of engineering students, computer science slots. And, you know, for the universities, it's more expensive to provide slots for engineering students, although IT is by itself, I think, the largest demand for STEM-skilled jobs growing in the future. In other words, there will be a need for engineers, but there's going to be a much greater need for more people in computer IT skill type careers going forward in the future when you look at the code.org stats. That being said, it's not just strictly our four-year university programs, but a lot of our community colleges have gotten into the game, and I think that's wonderful because that's going to definitely increase the capacity of producing IT degree program students, so there'll be greater output. When you look at education in Washington State, some of those bad numbers, I don't think it's always like when Ken Meyer was giving us grade reports, I think he was looking at K through 12 and not higher ed really more in terms of grading our system. So even though we're investing a lot more resources in K-12, our numbers aren't coming. Now, I don't know all the details of how the money is spent and what kind of performance we get for the bang for the buck. Lou, I think you may be right. I think higher ed may be relatively efficient. I know that Olympic College was mentioning how they became 30% more efficient in the last few years than they were before, and that was just recently.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I think it's a good thing. I think maybe, you know, the tight budgets have been the mother of the necessity of invention, and I think it drives a lot of them because they realize they cannot waste dollars because it just doesn't exist.
No,
so
I think that's very true.
They've done it. The problem, I think, in K-12 is metrics and standards. And, you know, unfortunately, Washington State kind of shot itself in the foot, or I should say WEAA, kind of helped us shoot ourselves in the foot with getting behind the getting basically against teacher standards, testing standards, and caused us to follow the No Child Left Behind Act and lose our waiver. And that causes
an issue.
Only a lack of funding, that only not only causes the lack of funding, but it causes other types of problems. So at some point in time, you know, first off, I do want to say to all the districts that are out there, the ones that are trying hard and doing a great job, you know, there is some good stuff out there. I'm not saying it's universally bad, but somebody has to look at the system, look at the way the money is being spent. And for instance, this I-1351, I think that was a bad idea. If you're going to put money in the system, you want to make sure that money is well spent, that it targets the problem, and that there's metrics and testing and standards so that you know that you're improving your end result. So that, for instance, we have a higher graduation rate. Will there lower
Lou, you had some comments you wanted to add?
Yeah, well, on the higher ed, the issue for Washington State is this quote-unquote leaky pipeline, right? I mean, we don't not enough kids are graduating from high school. I mean, so that's a problem. Too many kids, so again, I forget what the statistic is, you know, 100 kids that come in as freshmen, only, you know, 80 are graduating in 4 years. I mean, that's a problem. So then we've got a much lower four-year participation rate in Washington State of Washington State students in 4 years. That is a problem for sure. But what I'm saying is that the kids that are come into our 4 year system do well, and we're efficient for the ones that are in. The problem is the leaky pipeline between K-12 and higher ed, whether that's because our participation rate for community colleges is something among the top five in the whole U.S., which is great, right? So we're really good at that, but we aren't as good at getting our young people graduated from high school with a meaningful diploma and then into a four-year system. Now, of course, too, some of that is financial these days. Some of it is, you know, maybe the value of a four-year education isn't what it used to be unless you're in engineering or business or maybe a few other, you know, real key majors. So there may be some of that, too. But, I mean, that's the area where Washington is problematic, is that pipeline between K-12, our graduation rate, and participation in our four-year system. But our four-year system is a high-quality system for those that are in it. I mean, you look at, you know, world rankings for University of Washington, for example, you know, amazing, right? Washington State has a lot of great programs, and our regionals, you know, are doing a good job. And again, I agree with Charles. The budget necessities that they found themselves in over the past few years really forced some real hard looks at how they operated, you know, internally. But I see good things happening in education. It's just so hard to move quickly. I mean, when you talk about the business model for K-12, I mean, we're still talking in the agricultural era, much less the manufacturing era, much less the information era. So, I mean, you can't just throw more money at an ancient business model and expect it to change and be better. I mean,
exactly.
It's almost a whole rethinking of what does the school day look like. Summer vacations. I know for a lot of parents don't bring that up, but I mean, summer vacations, I mean, kids aren't working on farms anymore. I mean, you know, they're barely working period in the summer. So why we have this school year set up the way it is even is a throwback to an agricultural era that doesn't even exist anymore.
Yeah, that's very true. And I think it's one of those things where whenever you try to have a conversation about, you know, education or education policy or whatever, I mean, you always get that violin strings, you know, oh, it's about the kids, it's for the kids. And it's like, no, it's not for the kids, not anymore. We can hear, you know, when it's really for somebody else and when you're actually, you know, perpetuating a system for other benefits that sometimes don't have anything to do with kids. So let's switch gears here. Let's talk about healthcare.
Yeah.
Especially
sure.
since that's what you're doing. I mean, there are problems and improvements in that system, and then there's an open enrollment coming on the 15th.
Right.
You can talk about that. And then there's kind of a trade association coverage opportunity there. So why don't you just kind of talk to us about, I mean, it's certainly not a happy time for a lot of people.
Well, yeah. I mean, it's, you know, the Affordable Care Act certainly threw, you know, health care industry into a lot of paroxysms. If you go to, actually, I posted a couple of days ago on my WordPress blog, I think it's wordpress.com/LewisMcMurrin, just some things to know right now. So I'd say probably, so first off, if you're an individual and you're not otherwise covered by your spouse or an employer or exempt or on your parents' plan, then you've got to go in back into the market and either renew the plan you got last year or get a new plan. November 15th is the beginning of open enrollment, and you've got to make your payment and any changes by December 23rd close of business for policies that begin on January 1st. Your renewal should be coming in from your insurer, as well as if you're on a exchange plan, the exchange should have sent you some information about that too. So for those who've already been in the system, hopefully it won't be too difficult. I mean, I know last year, I know people that they waited to the last minute and then they couldn't get through the system and they got burned. So I would definitely do not wait to the last minute, get on and get into the system if you're going to do it as an individual and all that. Now, the other thing is that the employer mandate was delayed. So the employer mandate kicks in now for 2015 for employers with 100 or more FTEs, okay?
Okay.
70% of those employees have to be covered this year, and then 95% by 2016. For employers between FTE size of 50 to 99, they've got until 2016 to get those folks covered. So there is now, and that you can shop anytime on the, you know, through either through a broker, you know, on the business, you know, on the shop, the shop site, or you know, there are also private exchanges being built as well too. So there are options out there, and generally employers have, you know, generally some more options, but it's certainly not cheap. The one thing is now, deductibles have gone up, out of pocket maximums have gone up. This is what you get if you're going to cover pre-existing conditions, right? I mean, so society said, hey, you know, it's not fair that, you know, I mean, I don't know how widespread that is, but I mean, I think the general agreement was, okay, pre-existing, not being covered for pre-existing conditions, you know, is not a good thing. Well, okay, if you're going to cover that, then that's going to raise the cost of covering folks and treating people across that system. So again, too, no lifetime limits, no caps, right? You know, it used to be $1 million or sometimes $2 million cap on your insurance policy. Those are gone. So that can also has to be spread out, you know, has to be spread among the risk among all ratepayers. So your costs are going to go up there. If you are eligible for subsidies, and of course that's income-based and family-based and all that kind of thing, you do want to go through the exchange. If you are eligible for tax subsidies and you don't go through the exchange, you will not get those tax subsidies. So be aware of that. There are probably a million other things I could talk about here on the association side. So for a number of years, Washington was a unique state in that trade associations or quote-unquote member-governed groups had a carve-out from our state within our state law where they could come together for the purposes of selling insurance and provide that to their members. Well, the ACA, of course, layered on top, of course, state insurance regulation. Then we had, our insurance commissioner was somewhat hostile to association plans, some of it out of ignorance, some of it out of those that were, you know, maybe crossing a line and maybe not exactly hewing to the member-governed group or some of the other issues. But the ACA layered on top of it a much more difficult path for association health plans in our state. Essentially, you have to comply with the Department of Labor and the ERISA guidelines for member-governed groups. And that's a little bit harder test. And when I was at WTIA, we spent 18 months wrangling with the OIC over these issues. So a lot of associations did not go through the effort that, say, WTIA did and the Master Builders and AGC and some of the others that tuned up their governance, tuned up their bylaws, made sure that they were truly being governed by those that were insured, that the employer test that the DOL has you were passing among the relationships. So what used to be a very, very broad offering by trade associations in the state of Washington to its small business members has now been limited quite a bit. There are a lot fewer of those plans that are going to be approved by OIC because a lot of those groups did not go through the efforts that again WTIA and some of the other associations did to ensure that they fell under that essentially ACA exemption, and that the insurance commissioner kind of gave them a blessing, if you will, in writing. But they do exist. And again, too, this is why, again, it's often good to have a good broker who will do that shopping for you. Again, I can do that. The firm I work with is just great. But again, find a good broker who understands what's going on in the marketplace, what the regulatory situation is, and who can shop for you. Know what you want, too. I mean, you got to be out there. I mean, it's still a hard thing to shop for, right? It's certainly not like shopping for a car or appliances or or any number of things. Shopping for health insurance is still a pretty difficult process that really requires understanding your own budget, your family situation, your medical history, and all that kind of thing. But there is a lot of innovation going on in those unregulated areas of wellness, and a lot of companies are really getting into that, and that's an area where you can really move the ball. Again, too, a lot of healthcare costs are really because of our own lifestyle choices. I mean, the obesity problem in the United States is not related to having coverage or not having coverage, right? It has to do with how much exercise we're getting and, how much fruits and vegetables we're eating and paying attention to our overall health and not running to the doctor and maybe doing some better self-care. So there's what's interesting too, and I think in the Seattle area, again, we've got really strong healthcare institutions. You've got some pretty major players in terms of like Providence, Swedish, you got Regents, you got Primera. They are getting very innovative, and they are forming, interestingly, kind of almost venture funds to be looking at, what are some interesting areas that we can adopt that will move the ball and either improve care, save time for doctors. Again, things like that I'm working on, chronic disease management more effective. So there's a lot of interesting innovation going on. And just look at some of the companies that are getting funded. LimeAid getting $25 million and every move, and some of these other local startups are doing real well in this space. So it's a, it's an ever-changing area. Again, it's a huge portion of our economy. But frankly, if we do a better job of managing our own health, we can reduce our overall healthcare costs, especially because the regulatory factor, especially for small employers or even medium-sized employers, is pretty heavy duty in trying to comply and covering your employees. There's a lot of things you can have to think about. The IRS, the IRS complications also. I mean, and frankly, it's probably not a good idea to say, okay, well, I'm just going to take the fines and the fees instead of covering my employees at the certain levels that they need to be covered at. At least if you pay premiums for your employees, that's, it's a tax-deductible expense. The fines and the fees to the IRS are not tax-deductible. So, that's one thing to think about.
Well, it's interesting you bring that up, because I actually sat in a series of meetings by some elected officials who were going around and talking to community and business leaders about this, and there are some very conscientious employers that specifically said exactly what you're saying now. They said, we are going to take the fine instead of the expense of providing coverage because we can't do it. And
yeah.
That was a very interesting admission to make. It was not a pleasant thing to hear, but it's a reality. And I even had an experience this morning that just makes me want to pull out my hair and almost kill somebody. But it was one of those things where I was patched into a call with someone that is actually going through a transition from being covered for life, which is the way it started. They were going to be covered for life from their retirement plan, into getting into the Medicare age. And so now there's a provision in that agreement that says, now we're going to put you in some kind of a supplemental plan that will work with Medicare. And so they were speaking with this organization, and I don't know who this broker was or who this firm was, but they're talking to me and giving me the information, because I'm actually acting as the, kind of the legal advisor to this person. And in the background, you hear all kinds of talking and ambulances going past. It's almost like they're doing business outdoors. But the point is, that it was they're rallying off all of this information, and this is the the premium, and this is the the write off here, and this is what gets covered over here, and here's the max. And I said, well, I don't want to hear it. What I want you to do is I want you to send me something by email or fax or whatever. I want you to send me the documents of the three or four different proposals that you're trying to convince my client to take, because they're an elderly person. You're not going to get them to commit online by rattling off this information to them because they don't understand what you're saying. And I had a lot of resistance to that. It was, oh, well, you're never going to get the paperwork because it's Medicare. I said, oh, no, we're going to get the paperwork. But it was just one of those things that, you know, people are very, very disgruntled about what's happening in healthcare right now. They don't understand.
Yeah.
They're trying to get some clarity. There's a lot of bugs that need to be worked out. A lot of expenses are going through the roof for businesses, including my own, for the same level of coverage. And, you know, you really just want to get to a place where, you know, there is some kind of a clearinghouse or somebody that you can trust that can, you know, can be an advocate for you and go in there and find out the information and then kind of patch it down. So I'm glad that you're in the business of doing that.
Well, thanks. And I will admit, I mean, I give our insurance commissioner a hard time, and Mike and I are good friends going way back. But there's actually some very helpful information on oic.wad.gov about renewals and that kind of thing. And that's the thing, too. You know, Donya, one of the reasons I kind of got into, you know, sort of health insurance was, you know, change of this nature shakes things up, right? I mean, you know, the large brokers, they're going to do fine. But a lot of small brokers, this is going to probably say, you know, enough is enough. I'm not going to do it. I mean, they're having to really work harder now, too. I mean, you got to provide some good advice for your clients and really be out there and you know, and you know, there is opportunities to provide other kinds of services, too. I mean, there's, you know, brokers can do other things, but they're supposed to work for the client. And that's, again, why I really like the folks I work with at Pro Benefits. I mean, they really shop. I mean, they'll go shop, you know, 6, 8, 10 different plans, depending on your situation, and really find something for you with a different range of options. And, you know, it all still comes down to about four basic things, though, right? What's the deductible? What's the out-of-pocket? You know, what's my, you know, out-of-pocket maximum? What are my co-pays? And what does my network look like? And those are the things that are sort of basic. I would say the one thing about the ACA that is maybe, quote-unquote, good for consumers is that we have to pay a lot more attention now to our insurance policies and our health insurance policies, what's in them, and our doctors, and, you know, getting more clarity. Don't be afraid to ask, like, hey, you know, I'm coming in. What, you know, what is this going to cost me? You know, or, you know, what's this going to run? And, you know, trying to find just price transparency in procedures is difficult, if not impossible. So
I know Charles has comments about that.
Yeah. You know, I love this whole Virginia Mason thing. They're making I think they're actually offering a guarantee of certain surgeries, something pretty innovative, like, wow. I mean, in writing, I thought that was pretty interesting. But again, too, I think that our region is actually pretty blessed with some really interesting, effective, innovative healthcare institutions combined with an entrepreneurial bent in, you know, in this region. And, you know, I mean, we can be real leaders in, you know, in moving the ball and really in, especially on the wellness side and some other areas too. So, but it is confusing. Definitely ask for help. I mean, you know, I talk to people, it's like, yeah, I tried doing this myself last year. It's like, okay, feel free if you want to, but, you know, get help if you need it. So that's what I would suggest.
So I want to jump around a little bit more, and I'm going to see if Charles has anything to offer on that. But I kind of want to talk about cybersecurity and privacy. And then I also want to go back, because we didn't really talk about it. I want to talk about what you think about 2016. So,
oh, yeah.
So who wants to take what and which one sounds more interesting? We've probably got about 15 minutes, maybe a little bit less.
Yeah,
but,
you know, 2016, it's like, can we just get through 2014? Before I start making predictions about 2016, I mean, I don't know.
That's
I mean,
how it works, Lou.
Here's how. Right,
we
now
we got to make it out of this year alive first.
Well, sure.
Yeah,
I mean, I look at. I mean, really, the U.S. economy is doing pretty well right now. I mean, there's always risks, and it's very sectoral and all that. But I especially look at Washington State, and I don't see very many other places where I'd like to be positioned right now. I mean, we've got an aerospace sector, we've got a technology sector, we've got an agricultural sector, we've got trade. I mean, really, I mean, some of the bigger risks are economically, I think, are, you know, Europe and Asia are not doing well. That could be a problem for us selling apples and airplanes. So really, the global economy is important to Washington State. So, you know, and often it you know, that will the politics will be based on how is the economy doing. You know, you got this crazy stuff in the, you know, foreign policy realm, and clearly I think that the vote was, you know, I mean, let me put it this way. I mean, Bush set the bar so low after Katrina for competence in the federal government, and unfortunately, I think the Obama administration has lowered it. The Ebola thing, just some of the what's happening in the Middle East, and I mean, we're trying to get out of wars, but the wars just keep coming at us. You know, and as a libertarian, kind of, it's like, man, I want to be out of this foreign policy mess. But when America is disengaged, it only gets more dangerous. I mean, now we got, you know, Putin and Russia trying to become, you know, a Soviet empire again. I mean, it is a dangerous world out there.
Yeah.
Voters don't vote much on foreign policy except when it's going bad or going
exactly.
badly. So I don't know what people are thinking around that. In 2 years, I mean. Right now, the president and the administration and Congress have an opportunity to do some thing to govern, right? I mean, the Republicans need to govern. That's what the voters are saying. Okay, fine. I don't want to see Harry Reid, Harry the Crank anymore. I'll take Mitch McConnell's drawl over Harry Reid's, you know, scratchy old voice, but you better do something, you know?
Exactly.
And that's what people want. They want to see people govern well. And, you know, Reagan did it with a Democrat House. Clinton did it with Republican Congress. It can be done. It can be done if you don't use the legislative process purely as politics for 2 years. I mean, they actually need to actually govern.
I think that's part of it, too. I think that's part of why people think the red tide is just because of the usual backlash where I'm ticked off at the Democrats. I don't like what they're doing. So let me just go ahead and elect a lot of Republicans. And I think that's part of it for some people that are just hard, you know, dye-in-the-wool partisans, and there will always be that way. But I think
mm-hmm.
the other part of it is that people are doing it to say, here's your chance. You now have your majority. Now, instead of
right.
just sitting here and stopping everything the other side is doing, now you have an opportunity to show us
mm-hmm.
what you're really capable of or willing to do. And if you're
yeah,
not willing
yeah.
to govern, and if you're not willing to give up this stalemate, then we're going to vote you out again. So
yeah,
I think that
yeah.
that's part of why people are doing that. Charles, do you have any comments you want to make
yeah.
about what's going on?
Well, I will say that I think the vote is not so much a pro-Republican, but we're not happy with what government's been doing for us. That's
right.
really what I – is my take on it. In other words, the parties be damned at a certain level. You guys have to be efficient. You have to think about better ways to govern. You have to produce better results. You take something like Obamacare, and it tried to solve one problem, but it left so much undone, the idea being, oh, we'll come back and do it. Well, you never address the cost curve in healthcare. You can't solve healthcare by just trying to come up with a better insurance policy. I mean, it's a start, but that's only going to go so far. After a point in time, you're going to have to address the cost, the underlying cost of healthcare. Just like you're saying, you got to have transparency. You got to be able to make choices. And unfortunately, the pros and cons, it may have simplified things by saying, well, we're not going to allow certain policies that don't have coverage. On the other hand, you know, like let's say a very low value type insurance that doesn't provide a lot of coverage. So now instead of talking about the coverage, it's like you say, who are the providers? What are your deductibles, et cetera, et cetera. So they set the bar high there. But the problem, of course, is we haven't done anything to make healthcare, the production of healthcare really any more efficient. And the United States is actually one of the more inefficient healthcare systems. So basically, we've set the bar by saying, let's have expensive healthcare insurance, but let's not make the system more efficient. So we've basically layered on a cost that we can't afford. The reason so many people have dropped out and are even considering dropping out of healthcare is because they just can't afford it. I mean, a family of three is going to take you $20,000-$25,000 to cover a family of three. Are you kidding me? I mean, for a lot of people, that's a significant portion of their income. They spend more on healthcare than they do on their housing. That is significant. There's a lot of reasons for that. But I think that's what I think the anger in terms of the election is that we're promising, we're setting high standards, but we're not executing properly. We're not actually coming up with inefficiencies and innovations in government that say, let's figure out a better way of doing this, and let's not just figure out how to dole out the money, but let's try to figure out a way to do things better. And I think that's what people want to see. So, yes, the Republicans better deliver on that, but if they just, you know, take this as a, look, you voted for us, this is great, let us run with it, let's, you know, na-na-na-na on the Democrats, well, in 2 years, it'll be na-na-na back on the Republicans, and then it'll be na-na-na back on the Democrats, and it's just going to go back and forth.
And
Lou, I
changes.
Think you know this, too. It's oscillated. It's oscillated like three or four times now, and, you know, I think that's basically saying is stop taking this as a party vote and start taking it as a vote that says we want real change, not not lip syncing, not we'll make a great promise.
Lip syncing.
And, you know, we'll promise you better. It's like deliver us better.
Right.
Figure out a way to do this more efficiently. And that's why I think rules that lock you into a certain system and say and try to prevent innovation are bad rules. And that's where we got to be careful.
Go ahead. Will, you want to offer something else?
I would say, I think it points out this behemoth that we've created in Washington, D.C., this beltway, monster that, just sucks in all our money, and their job is just to keep as much as they can inside that beltway. And it's just, people are tired of it, but you can't keep giving them power. When Republicans can vote against Republican interests and Democrats can vote against Democrat interests, and they can do it together in one big bill, whether it's a tax reform bill, whether it's an immigration bill, whether it's just budget bills, right? I mean, what is the justification for subsidizing ethanol and sugar anymore? I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't see it. I mean, again, even things like Export-Import Bank. I mean, I know some of these are kind of Tea Party kind of things, but I think it makes a point. It's like, can we just stop doing something that has very little value? But it's going to, but the American people do speak, and, the wisdom of crowds is, continues to do it. And some of the online commentary is on the Democrat side is like, good luck, you're going to blow. You just care about the rich. It's like, okay, come on, guys, you're in denial here, folks. I mean, you got your rear ends handed to you for a reason, right? You did a bad job.
Right.
So, but again, too, like you said, Charles, it'll be handed back to them if they don't write. So you want to get in a little quick cyber privacy deal?
Yeah, let's talk about some cybersecurity.
Sure. Yeah, so let me throw you a couple of things out here. Again, I've been learning a lot more about cybersecurity and what's going on. I mean, it is a huge problem. I mean, you talked to Mark Anderson, of course. I mean, he's really big on this right now. I mean, it's intellectual property theft. Supposedly, $250 billion per year, is lost to intellectual property theft. $110 billion per year to cyber crime. Another 200 and something billion per year just in downtime and reputation damage, and average legal settlements for companies are $1 million, and the average cost of a data breach is almost $6 million. I mean, and this is for all size enterprises. I mean, I have a strong suspicion, I don't know for sure, that the vendor through which Target got hacked by a Russian teenager probably is out of business now. So, I mean, this is a huge, huge problem for intellectual property, for national security, for, financial information, and just for messing with websites. So it is an enormous problem on the cyber side. The privacy side, of course, is a lot more nuanced because is it privacy from Facebook? Is it privacy from NSA? Protecting your privacy, is a whole different ball game for, consumers. And of course, we want people that are holding our information to keep it held and private as well, too. So it's a huge problem. And it just, and part of it, too, is goes back to, responding to phishing and think like a lot of basic consumer stuff. I mean, still there's the ways people are getting into companies is sort of old fashioned phishing scams and email attachment scams. So part of it is still consumer and employee education, but let's face it, I mean, there are national bad actors out there that are going after intellectual property, national security secrets, and other things that, are very, very valuable to companies and consumers and, the society in general. So it's a big problem and really needs to be dealt with in a much more effective way.
And when you start talking about like cybersecurity and privacy, you are talking about national security issues. I was at the White House in July, where we had a meeting about that very thing. And at what point does it become something where the government, especially when you're talking about big data, open data, and government getting in the business of IT?
Right.
They've always
right.
been in the business, but you know what I mean. But it's one of those. And even the case that just happened with Microsoft, where they decided because they were going after somebody that they wanted to go after one of the clients. And have access to their corporate information, their emails. And so, Microsoft is fighting this all the way up to the Supreme Court. So, people are talking about cybersecurity. They're talking about ISIS on the one hand and all of these other wars that we're having. But the real wars that are coming and that are actually growing in magnitude are the cybersecurity and private
Absolutely.
Ones, where they're actually infrastructure, financial markets. I mean, there's a lot of stuff coming down the pipe that we really have to start looking at in that realm. Charles, did you have some comments? I know you do this for a living.
Okay. Okay, we should take every dime that we spend on ethanol subsidies, spend zero out that budget, and take every dime of it and spend it on cybersecurity. This is the kind of thing the government actually should be involved in, and where they should leverage their resources. And you know what? You know, where, you know, they need to be responding to the way the market and the industry is changing. Everything is going online. And you're right, at a basic level for the small business clients, not clicking on that email attachment. Well, you know, every once in a while somebody's going to do it anyways. They're going to get infected. Those aren't the things that I'm always worrying about. Sure, I don't like it. You know, we have to get malware off. I'm really concerned about the organized nation-state actors leveraging these tools to attack our infrastructure. I'm talking about major data breaches where they can compromise and steal billions of dollars, not 50,000 credit card accounts, but millions of credit card accounts. You know, that level, this is where the government should get involved in setting standards and helping provide resources to secure our cyber infrastructure, because if they don't, we could get our hat handed to us. We are one of the most, if not the most, cyber-dependent country in the world, and so there's an asymmetrical aspect to this attack. There isn't a lot of cyber infrastructure in North Korea or some of these Eastern Bloc countries to attack. On the other hand, we've got a lot of attack surface, and we have a lot of value, and we have a lot of intellectual property value. So when somebody's stealing using electronic tools, the payoff for them for a small investment is much greater than it is if we don't invest in our own security. So that's what I have to say about it. We have to invest in it, and we have to pay attention to it. And really, this is where policy needs to start thinking about investing resources instead of, like you say, Lou, why we have so many old legacy things out there, because the politics behind it, because the money behind it says you got to spend money certain ways, you know, to keep certain things going. And you know what? I think that's also part of the vote that went out there. People are tired of business as usual. They want to see things that don't matter anymore go away, and they want to see the money spent on priorities that do matter.
No, good point.
They want to see
good
some
point.
Innovation. They want to see innovation. They don't want to see any more, you know, antitrust type, you know, one person has control. I mean, you look at different things. I mean, it spends down in the other industry sectors, but you look at something as simple as Uber and the fight that, you know, Uber, what they're looking at, and the fight that they're having because of the medallions and the competitive advantage that they provide. And you know, it's just that disruption. And so, you know, that our society, because of technology, but just because of basic evolution, we're kind of tired of status quo, and we're looking for new ways to do things. So I think that's part of it.
Yeah. This disintermediation happens.
Yes.
So any other final
does.
Comments from either one of you guys? You want to give us some URLs or some Facebook pages or something we can go back
to? I want to call it a couple cool little startups in sort of, I guess what we call it, in the government space. One of them is called QuickWIC, QUICKWIC.com. And this is an app that helps the folks, primarily, you know, single moms who are on the WIC program. It's a mobile app and helps them manage those budgets and those shopping carts a lot more effectively than now, where, you know, the big problem comes at the checkout counter. You know, if somebody grabbed, you know, the wrong loaf of bread or the wrong kind of eggs or wrong milk, then it becomes a big nightmare at that checkout stand, right? And QuickWIC is one is a mobile app that will help, you know, manage that better, and it's really, really cool. The other one I wanted to mention is Simplify, S-I-M-P-O-L-F-Y, and this is another startup in Seattle that is making an attempt to match up actual bills in Congress with and voting records with where you stand on issues, so you can really get a much more complete view of really what the voting record is of, you know, folks in Congress, what the bills actually say, and where you stand on them, so you can really get a much better idea, you know, separate from listening to speeches and getting, you know, campaign mailers about that. So that's an interesting Simplify, S-I-M-P-O-L-F-Y.com. And then, again, for those that are for singles out there, Siren.Mobi. It's an interesting new dating app. I had a nice conversation with the CEO yesterday, and for those that are looking for love online, Siren.Mobi might be the way to go. And it's a it's only in Seattle right now, but they're going to be opening up in some other cities soon. So anyway, thank you for that offer of free advertising for these folks that will now love me very much.
Yeah, I was going to say, who knew you were a pimp, Lou?
Well, I was a lobbyist, so what can I say?
Oh, that's right. Wait a minute. What am I saying here? Well, I wanted to thank you guys for tuning in this afternoon and make everybody aware that you can find this broadcast as a podcast at the site that you are using right now or on Facebook at /STR8TalkRadio. That's Sam, Tommy, Roger, 8 Talk Radio. Be sure to like us there and follow us here. And another big shout out to Tim Ryan Construction. I mean, they have really been helping us this afternoon. Yay, yay. A great company with great people and let us broadcast on site after that power outage. So thank you, Lou.
Charles. My pleasure. Thanks very much.
Thank you, guys. And this
really,
is your host,
really
Sonia Keating, signing off at 3 p.m. Pacific Time, Thursday, November 6th. And we will see you next time.